Okay, good morning, everybody. Good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning. Good morning. How come I can't hear myself? Good morning. How's that? Good enough. All right, so this is Bible 231, and it's October 13th. We started the introductory chapter to nervous system last time, so we're going to finish up that today. And so we're pretty much just right on schedule. When I look at the schedule, I see that your next lecture exam is on October 25th. That was 2 weeks from Monday, which is 1 week from this coming Monday. All right, so it's a week and a half away. And it's going to cover muscles and, just skeletal muscle, that introductory chapter on skeletal muscles, plus all the gross anatomy of muscles, origins, insertions, et cetera, and also this first chapter on the nervous system, right? So we're still talking about what's going to be on the test. And then that's it, just those three chapters. All right, so what we have on the screen is what we were talking about last time. That light I want to leave on. Okay, so practicum started. There's a group that's going to take a practicum today at noon, and it's going to be just a little late because I still have to set it up. So it's going to be maybe 5 minutes afternoon, 10 minutes afternoon, something like that. So just be patient outside, and it's just going to take me a second to set up. Okay, so let's see. Here's a neuron, right? This yellow thing. And remember the three parts of a neuron. We got these dendrites. These are processes. These are short, highly branched. And then we have the cell body with the nucleus and a bunch of organelles inside here. So that's what we call cytoplasm. And then one really long process right here that we call an axon. And remember that nerve impulses move from a dendrite into the cell body and down an axon, and not the reverse direction. And nervous system, or nervous tissue, is composed of two different kinds of tissues. There are neurons, which we see in yellow right here, and neuroglia cells, which are support cells, that we see kind of in white. And on this particular axon, we see a Schwann cell wrapping itself around an axon, and it is producing a myelin sheath around this axon, and that speeds up the rate of conduction of an impulse down an axon. So a nerve impulse will actually hop from one node of Ranvier to another, to another, to another, and it's hundreds of times faster than if the action potential had to sweep down an axon molecule by molecule by molecule, just like if you were running upstairs, all right? Then down over here, the axon terminals, these are what we call the synaptic terminals or axon terminals. These things release signaling compounds that we call neurotransmitters into a synapse that will stimulate a cell next to it over here. All right, so this would be the proximal cell or the presynaptic cell, and if it's stimulating another cell in this area here, that would be called the postsynaptic cell, the distal cell in this synapse. All right, so that's a very important exam figure. Okay, I'm not going to go over that micrograph. All right, so let's see, what are we going to talk about? Neurons. Let's talk about, we're going to look at some cell shapes of neurons versus neuroglia. And I don't think you have these pictures in your book anymore. I think they're in Blackboard. If not, I'll make sure that they are in Blackboard because they're important figures for you. All right, so there are three important shapes of neurons. All right, so don't forget, there are neurons and neuroglia, and we're contemplating neurons right now. And what's the job of a neuron? It transmits information as an electrical signal really fast over long distances in the body. All right, so here is one type of cell, and this is a multipolar neuron. Not really drawn to scale, because these dendrites and cell body, they're microscopic, right? So you need a microscope to see it. But this axon right here could be as long as a meter, going from your spinal cord all the way down to the tip of your toe, right? So it's not exactly to scale, but that's okay. This right here is what we call a motor neuron. So the function of this kind of shape is a motor neuron. And what the heck is motor? All right, so if we look over here at the screen on the your right, all right, oops, I got to click, a motor neuron, okay, is some kind of neuron that takes information from the periphery, all right, to the central nervous system. A motor neuron, other way around, takes information from the central nervous system out to the periphery. Right, so we call that motor or what? Efferent. So this is a typical kind of shape that we would see for an efferent neuron. And here we see the cell body. So here is a transverse section of the spinal cord. And where is the spinal cord located? What part of the nervous system is that? That central nervous system, right? So this dot represents the cell body and dendrites. And then this long axon leaves the spinal cord and finds its way all the way to this muscle. Ooh, what muscle does that look like? It could be a biceps. Could be sternocleidomastoid. Any of those would be good examples. So it's taking information from CNS to the periphery. That's an excellent example of a multipolar neuron function, right? It's a motor function. It's not sensory. The other function for a multipolar neuron is that it's going to share information within the central nervous system. Here is another multipolar neuron. There's the cell body. Here's an axon. Of course, it's much shorter, but it's still going to have this shape. So multipolar neurons are for sharing information and for sending information to the periphery. That's its job. All right, the next kind of neuron, and how do I know this is a neuron here? By color. What's the color? Yellow, just like that multipolar neuron. Now this one, all right, we call a bipolar. It has a single cell body and a single nucleus, but it has two long projections. It almost looks like it has two axons, but not really. One is really a dendrite. Here are the small branching processes. They fuse together to form this single process. It enters the cell body, and then here is the axon, and here are the axon terminals. This is what we call a bipolar because these two processes are on either side of the cell body. This kind of neuron is important for special senses. Not very many places of the body have a bipolar neuron, but they're found in the eyes, okay, and in the ears, and that's really good examples. All right, so they're not going to be found in the periphery or central nervous system, but in special sense organs like eyes and ears. Okay, let me go back to the previous slide. This right here is a multipolar neuron, remember? And its one function is for motor or efferent, but here is that association neuron. Notice that the association neuron is found where? A central nervous system or peripheral nervous system or in both places?
No,
only in the central nervous system. This neuron, right, this multipolar neuron, if it is an interneuron or association neuron, is so small that it is completely contained within the central nervous system, and that's the only kind of neuron that is completely contained within the central nervous system, and that is an interneuron or association neuron. Motor neurons are partly in the central nervous system, partly in the peripheral nervous system. Bipolar neurons are found peripheral nervous system only. They're not found in the central nervous system. So that's kind of like the counterpart to the association neuron. And then the last kind of neuron, all right, is what we call a unipolar neuron. A unipolar neuron, we see the cell body right here. There's a single process coming out of it. So we call this just a single short process, and then it bifurcates. And when I say bifurcates, what does that mean? It just splits into two, bi meaning two. All right, I just want to go to the right page over here. All right, so we're talking about these different kinds of neurons right here. Okay, so this is unipolar. Sometimes it's called a pseudo-unipolar, like quasi-unipolar, because it has one process coming out. It splits into two. And these two processes right here, this is the process that we find in the peripheral nervous system. Right, and here are dendrites that receive information, and this is the central process. This is the part that enters the central nervous system. All right, so this neuron, again, partly is where? In the peripheral nervous system and partly in the central nervous system. It's not contained in one or the other. And then here are these little swellings. Again, these are the synaptic terminals or axon terminals, so that's why we know this is a nice axon. So if we place this neuron in position in the body, here we see some, what does this cube look like? Yeah, you could say skin, but go ahead, impress me. Integument, yeah, you know that. So integument, I'm just pulling your leg a little bit, right? That's your integument right there, surface of your body, largest organ in your body. All right, so here are some receptors. These receptors send impulses through this process right here of a sensory neuron. What do we call this process? Okay, this process right here, is it in the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? Peripheral nervous system. So this is the peripheral process, right? So this part right here is this part right here. So these are dendrites. Peripheral process, since it's in the peripheral nervous system, peripheral part of your body. Then it enters the spinal cord right here. So this is what we call the central process because it enters the central nervous system. Right? So we use those terms repeatedly all the time. When we say something is located centrally, what do we mean? It's located in the central nervous system. A good place, a good guess would be brain. Okay? We say it's located peripherally, it's not in the brain or spinal cord, it's in some other region of the body. All right, so we're going to talk about the spinal cord at another later time. But I do want you to know those three shapes of neurons. All right, multipolar, and the function is motor or association neuron. All right, then we got the bipolar for special senses like vision, and then we have the pseudo-unipolar, which is always going to be in a sensory neuron, all right? But remember, what do we call a sensory system? Is it afferent or efferent? It's afferent, right? So this is an afferent nerve. The pseudo-unipolar is an afferent nerve. What about this one right here, this multipolar? This is an efferent nerve because it's what? A motor nerve, all right? So we're kind of using some of those terms over again. All right, let's look over at the slide on the right once again. Come on, Mr. Cursor. There we go. All right, so those are neurons, and they send electrical information fast over long distances in the body. The second type is what we call a support cell or neural glial cell, or you could call it a neuroglia cell. Either way, right, there are a number of them. They're located in different parts of the nervous system, and again, what are the two main ways you might want to break the nervous system down into? Central versus peripheral, and that works for this scheme too. All right, so let's look at some that are found only in the central nervous system, and here's your list. Astrocytes, microglia, ependymal cells, and oligodendrocytes. Now those you have pictures of in your book, all right, and I have pictures of here too. Yeah, there it is. There's my cursor. All right, so let's find where these guys are at. Okay, so here is what an astrocyte looks like. Here you see a neuron, and that could be just a multipolar neuron. And then in the beige color, green or brown, what color is that? Beige, okay, beige, that's some kind of color. And this is not a neuron because it has the wrong color, but it also has the wrong kind of shape. It kind of looks like a star with a bunch of light rays coming out of it, right? Lots of different processes poking out in all different directions. There's not one process that's longer than the other, right? And so therefore somebody said, oh, well, that's an astrocyte, meaning what? It looks like a star. Okay, so here's an astrocyte, and it's in the central nervous system. So here we can see that this astrocyte has some processes that are surrounding this blood vessel right here, namely a capillary. And that process then goes into the cell body, and there's another process that hooks up to the neuron, right? And that could be a dendrite or an axon or even the cell body right here. So this astrocyte forms a barrier around blood vessels so that if there are toxins in the blood, it can't automatically leak out of the blood into the brain and intoxicate these cells and decrease their function, right? Which would decrease your function as well, right? Your consciousness might knock you out, for instance. All right, so astrocytes make something called the blood-brain barrier. So not anything that's in the blood can have access to your brain. It helps protect your brain. But your brain does need certain kinds of compounds, like glucose, right? It's an important energy molecule. So an astrocyte can take glucose that's in the blood and deliver it exactly to this neuron right here. It can act like a special delivery system. That's another job of an astrocyte, okay? Another job of an astrocyte is that it will tell neurons how to connect up with each other, how to make synapses, right? And astrocytes can even tell neurons to regenerate and to grow, or to grow new dendritic processes to make new connections. So that's just a structural way that we could think of how our brain actually learns things. When neurons make new connections and grow new dendrites and make connections with other neurons, that's a learning process for that person. All right, so that when you learn something, one explanation for learning, right, you have additional function in your brain. What does that mean? That the structure of your brain is actually changing, and that's being directed by these astrocytes right here. So that's a pretty revolutionary, very important kind of thought, because when you take a class like anatomy or physiology or something, what's happening to your brain? Because you're learning a lot of information. It's growing, it's changing. Yeah, it's morphing, right? The structure of your brain is actually changing. And a lot of times in an anatomy class, the last part of the class actually is a little bit easier than the first part of the class, because what has happened? Your brain has changed, right? Which is actually pretty scary that you turn your brains over to instructors, right? That change the shape of your brain, the structure of your brain. All right, that's the job of an astrocyte. Okay. Another kind of neuroglia cell in the central nervous system, this is a little bit smaller cell, we call this a microglial cell, and this one can crawl around inside your brain and look for things that don't belong there, like not bad thoughts, okay, not thoughts for instance, but bacteria and viruses and fungi and things like that. Or if there's a nerve cell that has died for whatever reason, or if there's a tumor cell, these microglia cells then will attack and destroy and phagocytize the remains of that cell and keep your brain healthy. So a microglial cell is an immune cell, right? Kind of like a white blood cell that we find in the central nervous system that keeps your brain healthy. All right, so we call that a macrophage. It gobbles things up that don't belong in your brain. All right, another kind of cell. In your brain, there are cavities we call ventricles, or there's other little cavities that we call like the aqueductus sylvius and things like that. And that fluid in those cavities is separated from the neurons of your brain by this layer right here. Just like astrocytes make a blood-brain barrier, there's a little barrier between the cerebrospinal fluid that we find in those cavities and these neurons right here. And so these cells we call ependymal cells. And you can see some of them have these ciliated processes on them. Some of these ependymal cells join with capillaries to actually secrete that fluid into the cavity. All right, so this fluid right here is called cerebrospinal fluid. That's the fluid that your brain is floating in, so that fluid helps float your brain so it's not quite so heavy, doesn't get quite so damaged when it's sloshing around inside your head, right? And it's these ependymal cells that make that fluid, but they also act like a little barrier. So for instance, if there are bacteria in the cerebral spinal fluid, they don't have direct, easy access to the rest of your brain. That's the job of these ependymal cells. And then lastly, we have these cells. All right, we see some of these gold processes from some kind of neuron, maybe a multipolar neuron going someplace. All right, and this oligodendrocyte is wrapping itself around the axon. If these wrappings weren't here, the speed of conduction of a nerve impulse would be relatively slow. Right? But because oligodendrocytes are wrapping a myelin sheath around these axons, what about the speed of conduction of a nerve impulse? it speeds up. It can hop from one end of this oligodendrocyte to the other, right? Speeding it up a tremendous amount. So this oligodendrocyte we see is a lot different than a Schwann cell because it can form a myelin sheath around one axon and another one, all from the same cell body right here. So there are many processes that poke out of the cell body that can insulate or form a myelin sheath around many axons, not just one. Oligodendrocytes we see in the central nervous system. And interestingly enough, right, we think it's these oligodendrocytes that actually prevent regeneration of these axons when they get damaged. Okay, because these oligodendrocytes are really concerned about tumors forming in the central nervous system. We don't want to have tumors in the brain or cancer in the brain. Oligodendrocytes probably prevent that from happening, but in the process, it prevents this axon from regenerating if it gets damaged, like a spinal cord injury, for instance, because don't forget, spinal cord is part of what part of the nervous system? It's part of the central nervous system, and it has these guys in it. All right, as opposed to the peripheral nervous system. Now we're going to talk about support cells in the peripheral nervous system. So here is a pseudo-unipolar neuron. Right, here's a single process. This is the peripheral process that's going out to some receptors, for instance, in the integument. This is the part that's entering the spinal cord, so this is the central process. So this part of the neuron is in the peripheral nervous system. These cells form a myelin sheath around axons in the peripheral nervous system, and we call those Schwann cells. Right? These cells don't inhibit regeneration of this axon. As a matter of fact, they help promote it, so that when you have peripheral nerve damage, a lot of times those nerves will grow back and reinnervate organs and receptors. You know, it might take a year, for instance. I don't know if it will happen after that. Right? It could happen in a couple weeks to maybe as long as a year. People can regain sensory ability in various parts of their body after surgery. So, for instance, if somebody has cosmetic surgery on their face and a bunch of nerves are damaged, then you might have a sensory deficit in one cheek. After about a month or two, you will slowly regain function or sensation in that part of your body as these Schwann cells help the regeneration of that axon back to those receptors. Okay, so there's a big difference between oligodendrocytes and Schwann cells and how they allow regeneration to take place. The last kind of cell that we see that's not a neuron, but it's a support cell. There are support cells that we call satellite cells that surround the cell body of this pseudo-unipolar neuron that maintain the health of the cell body of this afferent neuron. We just call that a satellite cell because they kind of look like they're surrounding like the sun in a solar system kind of model, like an astronomy model. All right, so here would be a good example of the sun, and then there are different planets circling around, and so they call those satellite cells. Okay. All right, I think we talked about that last time, the myelin sheath. Okay. So, let's talk about nerve conduction. Nerve conduction a little bit. Oh, no, I don't want to go there. I want to go here. And I want to just look at an axon. All right, so we'll just look at this bipolar cell. All right, so an impulse will go from dendrite to cell body down the axon. And this particular axon, is it myelinated or not myelinated? It's not myelinated. So what about the speed of a nerve impulse here? It's relatively slow. That kind of conduction, if we look over on the slide on the right, is what we call continuous conduction. It's relatively slow for non-myelinated fibers. All right? If it is a myelinated fiber, that kind of conduction that's fast is called saltatory conduction. Right? Saltatory conduction means the axon has to be myelinated, and then it's very fast. Okay. All right, so the next topic that we want to talk about is how do neurons communicate with each other? And they communicate to each other through something called a synapse. All right, so let's take a look at a couple neurons talking to each other. All right, so here we see one neuron. Can anybody tell me what the shape of this neuron looks like? Here are some dendrites. Here's a cell body, one long axon. Here are a couple of axon terminals right here. Okay. This is a multipolar neuron. A good example, a good function of a multipolar neuron, remember, is a motor neuron or association neuron. And a nerve impulse will flow from dendrite, the cell body, down an axon. And then that information has to be passed to this second neuron right here. And there's a special junction between these two cells that we call a synapse. So you have to know something about the structure and function of this synapse. And remember I told you what the structural and functional unit of life was? What is that? A cell. Pretty complicated object, but if you understand a cell, you have a pretty good idea of what life is all about. What about the structural and functional unit of compact bone? Osteon. Yeah, you know, it's got the organic materials, the inorganic materials, the lamellae and cells and all that kind of stuff. Well, the next structural and functional unit that we're going to look at is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. Structural and functional unit of communication. And that is a synapse. All right, and here is a synapse, but we need to zoom into this region right here. So that is how information goes from the presynaptic cell, the cell that is proximal to the synapse, how it makes its way through the synapse into the postsynaptic cell, which is the cell that's distal to the synapse. Right? It goes right here. So here, it's just a nice simple illustration. I see two cells. Here's the synapse. And notice that these two cells, are they touching each other or not? They're not touching each other. Okay. All right, so how is information passed from this dendrite through the cell body down this axon? As an electrical impulse, a nerve impulse, as an electrical signal. But because there's this space between cells, that electrical signal can't hop across. Right? Because if it did, then it would be like static electricity. If you were to touch somebody, it would spark. It would be like a lightning bolt. And you don't have any lightning bolts between cells that have a space right here. So the information has to be converted into something else. And what we're going to talk about is a synapse that's called a chemical synapse. So when we have a chemical synapse, information is transmitted through the presynaptic cell as an electrical signal. Then it gets converted into a chemical signal that moves from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell, and that starts another electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell, and then it zips off down the axon once again. So for an electrical synapse, information is transmitted as an electrical signal in the presynaptic cell, as a chemical signal across the synapse, and then converted back into an electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell. That's how information is transmitted. So let's look at an enlarged area of this axon terminal right here. This is really good. So here we have the presynaptic cell, the postsynaptic cell, synapse in between. And let's zoom into this region. So here is the axon terminus with this little Bouton terminale, this little swelling that contains a lot of mitochondria. What's the job of mitochondria? Yeah, makes a lot of ATP, powers a cell, because this part of the neuron requires a lot of ATP, requires a lot of energy. It also contains a lot of synaptic vesicles. And these synaptic vesicles contain that chemical signal that's going to move across the synapse to excite the postsynaptic cell. So when I say presynaptic cell, do you know what I'm talking about? Like this one right here, where I have the cursor. Is this the presynaptic cell or postsynaptic? Postsynaptic. Ah, that's true, because here is the presynaptic cell, right? Proximal to the synapse. Okay, so when a nerve impulse comes down, it moves across the cell membrane, and it allows for calcium to enter this synaptic button right here, or the axon terminus. And so now you have a high level of calcium inside the cell, and that's going to cause these vesicles to fuse with the presynaptic membrane right here. So vesicles fuse as a result of that calcium signal. And when they fuse, remember, these are just membrane-bound organelles, and it's the same kind of membrane that we see right here. When it fuses, it exocytoses that signaling molecule into the space between the cells, and the space is called the synaptic cleft. And then these molecules move by diffusion, going from high concentration to low, high concentration by the presynaptic cell to low by the postsynaptic cell, and they bump into the postsynaptic cell. Right? There are special things called receptors that these molecules bind to, and that starts another electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell, and away goes that signal down through the dendrite, over the cell body, and then down the axon of the postsynaptic cell. All right, so here is a really good example of a synapse. You've got the presynaptic cell, the postsynaptic cell. You've got synaptic vesicles with these signaling compounds on the inside. And what I didn't tell you, what the general name of that signaling molecule is that gets exocytosed into the synapse. That's called, because it's coming from a neuron, it's called a, and it's transmitting a signal, right, to the postsynaptic cell over here. It's called a neurotransmitter. So the general name is neurotransmitter. And there are various neurotransmitters that are used in your body, but one that's very, very common is called acetylcholine that many neurons use. And the synapse between a neuron and a muscle cell uses acetylcholine as well, right? And maybe you've heard of some other kinds of neurotransmitters like norepinephrine. Maybe you've heard of serotonin. Maybe you've played around with some of those neurotransmitters in your life by taking, what, LSD or cocaine or things like that that mimic different neurotransmitters, right, that then set up different electrical activity in different parts of a person's brain, okay, which could be really, really dangerous when you play around like that, okay. So that's what a neurotransmitter is. It's the chemical that takes information, what, across the synapse that starts another electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell. Okay. All right, now who's got some questions about this synapse? What is a synapse? It's a structural and functional unit of what? Communication between these two neurons right here. All right, there's a point that I kind of glossed over really quickly. When this impulse comes down to this axon terminus right here, the signal for fusing of these vesicles to the presynaptic membrane is calcium. So you have to have proper levels of calcium in your blood and extracellular fluid in order for these neurons to communicate with each other. All right, so before you took a physiology class or anatomy, what did you think calcium was good for? Bones, just structure, right? Making strong bones. Is that an important thing in your body? Absolutely. Otherwise, you get osteoporosis, right, and you can fracture bones. But what do you think is more important, to have really strong bones or to have functional synapses between neurons so that they can communicate with each other? If you were going to choose, if you had a limited amount of calcium, where would you put it, in your bones or in your brain so that your brain functions? Yeah, and your body makes that decision too, and that's one of the reasons why, as we get older, right, and our body has trouble metabolizing calcium, it makes that same choice. It takes calcium from bones and puts it in other parts of your body where it's even more important to have calcium. Okay, so that kind of underscores why it's important to have proper calcium in your diet and exercise, because exercise makes strong bones. That means you can store more calcium in case you need it for proper brain function later, right? So bones really store calcium in our body as well as make bones strong. All right, so that's a nice synapse right there, right? The structural and functional unit of communication. All right, so that's everything here that I talked about that you have to be interested in. So let's maybe look at some of these questions that I have. Yeah. Okay. So I have a cursor right here. And so you're interested if there's damage where? Oh. If there's a problem right here? Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. For instance, I'll give you a sometimes yes. When somebody has a stroke, all right, maybe a mild stroke, and this neuron right here actually dies because it's not getting oxygen because that blood vessel to that part of the brain was damaged, all right, then other synapses in the brain can be taught to take over that function. All right, and so certain people under certain circumstances can regain motor control over a part of their body that has been paralyzed, or sensory feeling in a part of their body that was damaged by a stroke, they can get over that. All right, but there's other times, for instance, there's parts of the brain that use a transmitter called dopamine, and when those neurons degenerate, right, there's no other system to take up the slack, and people come down with things like Parkinson's disease, and they lose that control of their body pretty much for the rest of their life. We're trying to figure out ways to prevent the progression of that disease and maybe how to reverse it, but we haven't figured out how to do that yet. Like the disease Michael J. Fox has, Muhammad Ali, those are due to damaging of just trauma, in Muhammad Ali's case, right, of these neurons in a part of the brain that controls motor functions. Yeah, so those we don't know how to regenerate. So sometimes yes, yeah, sometimes no. And ahead of time, a lot of time physicians don't know if it will regenerate or not. Like when you have a stroke, they say you have a chance. And some people get over a stroke and some don't. Depends on the magnitude of the damage. And maybe how they've used their brain in the past too. Right? The more active your brain is, the more that you learn something. What does that mean? What does your brain have to do when you're learning things? It has to grow and change. And if your brain is adept at growing and changing, if you have like a young brain that's always learning something, so that by the time you get into your 80s, if you still learn a new language every year or play a new musical instrument every year, you have a young brain and you have a stroke, guess what? You probably are more likely to recover from a stroke because that your brain is more adept at changing. We call that plasticity. So that always helps. Okay. What is a neuron made out of? The neuron, that's just a cell. So it has what? A plasma membrane right here, right? And here is the plasma membrane that's surrounding the cell body. And inside the cell body, you've got endoplasmic reticulum. You've got a nucleus that contains DNA. And you have that dark spot inside the nucleus. What's that called? Nucleolus. So a neuron has pretty much everything else that a normal cell has, except it has special little things in the plasma membrane that allow it to transmit an electrical impulse. And you got to really get into a physiology class to understand how that works. But I think we're going to talk about it a little bit in this class, at least give you a little bit of a basic understanding of how that happens. Okay? So it's just a cell. It's just a living cell, but the shape is a lot different than what you'd find in an epithelium, because what are the shapes that you see in an epithelium? They're either flat or they're square or columnar, right? But those wouldn't work very well. Those shapes wouldn't work very well for transmitting impulses, right, meters away. It has to look more like a wire, like this axon right here. So these cells have a different shape because they have a different function. Yeah, they have a different function, right? Okay. All right, so let me look at these slides over here. Here's actually a micrograph of a synapse, right? So here is the axon terminus of the presynaptic cell. Here's a synapse that's really small. Here's the postsynaptic cell. And of course, since it's a cell, here is what? An organelle, mitochondria, for making ATP. Neurons need a lot of ATP. And I think I've talked about that before, because in your brain, you have a lot of neurons. This mitochondria here needs oxygen to make ATP. And when your heart stops, blood isn't going to your brain. It's not delivering oxygen to your brain. These mitochondria can't make ATP. When does your brain run out of ATP and you lose consciousness? How long does it take? Seconds, 2 to 3 seconds, right? So that cell runs out of energy. And then those cells are going to die if they're cut off of oxygen and the mitochondria can't make ATP. When does the cell actually die when it doesn't have oxygen? Yeah, about 2 to 3 minutes. All right, so that's how much ATP these mitochondria have to produce, because what's happening at this synapse? Oh, man, a lot of activity, right? All these vesicles are moving around. That takes ATP, right? Building neurotransmitter, that takes ATP. There's a lot of energy that's being used in the brain all the time. Okay, so let's look at electrical transmission a little bit on this next slide. Now, you don't have this in your book anymore. Okay, so I'll provide this slide to you. And there, every cell in your body, this is actually kind of freaky to first think of it, right? Acts like a battery. And when you have a battery, like in your car or your cell phone, it has terminals, electrical terminals. How many terminals does a battery have? Two. There's one positive one and one negative, right? And so that just means that electrons, or things that have a charge on them, can flow from one terminal to the other, because opposite charges attract each other. All right, when you have a cell like this neuron right here, nice multipolar neuron, it just so happens that the inside of the cell becomes negative and the outside becomes positive. What does that remind you of? A battery with two terminals. One is positive and one is negative. And these charges, what? Attract each other. Now, one of the reasons why the inside of the cell is negative and the outside is positive is because of some ions. And an ion is a chemical compound that has an electrical charge on it. Sometimes they're called electrolytes. And if you've ever volunteered or work in a hospital, or if you've had blood drawn, sometimes they measure your electrolyte levels, because that affects this electrical charge or the battery nature of all these cells in your body. All right. And if a cell can't maintain negative on the inside and positive on the outside, what would you tell me about that cell? Suppose you had a battery and there was no charge difference between the two terminals. What would you tell me about that battery? Like for your car? It's dead. It's a dead battery. Same thing for this cell right here. It would be a dead cell. Okay. All right, so there is an ion that's called potassium, and its chemical symbol is K. All right, that's because it was named after the Greek word for potassium, which is kalium. All right, so you don't have to know for this class chemical symbols. All right, it's high inside the cell, so you might. I'll give you the slide with sodium, with potassium high on the inside. And the ion that's high on the outside is sodium. And the chemical symbol for sodium is natrium, because that's how you say it in Greek, right? It's Na, natrium and kalium, so sodium and potassium. So a cell has high sodium on the inside, high sodium on the outside, high potassium on the inside, acts like a battery, but a nerve can be stimulated, right? It can be excited. And when it's excited, right, this sodium can rush inside the cell. Because why? Opposite charges attract each other. So sodium rushes in. What happens to the charge inside the cell? It kind of goes away, right? And as a matter of fact, so much sodium rushes in that it actually gets to be a little positive on the inside of the cell. And then that stimulates this next segment of the membrane for sodium to rush in. Right, so when sodium rushes in, we call that first phase of a nerve impulse depolarization. Right, and so then that depolarization will roll down the axon from the cell body down to the axon terminus. All right, and then after the depolarization takes place, then potassium leaves the cell, and look what it does. It regenerates the battery nature of that cell. So this cell now looks like it was when it was at rest. All right, so a nerve impulse, what I want you to know, a nerve impulse has two parts to it. All right, the first part is depolarization. The second part is repolarization. That's how an electrical signal moves down an axon. All right, so if we put depolarization and repolarization together, we get something called an action potential. And the other thing that I want you to memorize is, what is depolarization caused by? It is sodium entering the cell. Repolarization is potassium leaving the cell. That's so important when you get to a physiology class. It's good that you kind of brush up against these concepts in anatomy, so it's not totally foreign to you by the time you get to a physiology class. Okay? Okay. Yeah. Okay, so let's see if I have it in my notes. Let me just see if I have it written down. If I don't have it written down anywhere. Okay. Yeah, I got it written down right here. Okay, the resting cell membrane potential. There's high sodium concentration on the outside of the cell compared to the inside. So I'm looking at the slide on the right. High potassium concentration on the inside compared to the outside, just like what we have right here. So an action potential. How many phases does it have? One, two. All right, the first phase is excitation, which we call depolarization. The battery nature of the cell goes away, and that's because sodium enters the cell. And then for the cell to get back to normal again, it has to repolarize, and it repolarizes by potassium leaving the cell, which is the second part. We call that repolarization. So that's just something I know it sounds is really foreign to you guys, but I think you should just memorize that. Okay. And remember, when we look at a membrane, way back when we looked at a cell, it would take me too long to find that diagram. But what's your basic idea of a cell membrane, the simplest idea that you have for a cell membrane? It has two layers. What did we call that, those two layers? Phospholipid bilayer. Okay, phospholipid bilayer has two layers. But a real membrane has more than just two layers. It has other stuff that's added to those two layers that give it special functions. And those we call proteins. And those proteins could be enzymes, or they could be channels, ways for ions to move across the membrane from one side to the other. So these ions, if I look at the slide on the left, these ions can move across the membrane because there are ion channels put in the membrane of certain cells, like nerve cells, so that they can conduct electrical impulses. So if I look on the slide on the right over here, it says, what membrane component allows sodium and potassium ions to passively move across the cell membrane? And those are those proteins, those ion channels that open and close to allow this, if I look on the slide on the left, to allow this nerve impulse to move down a cell. Okay, so that's all fairly complicated, but what I want you just to memorize, action potential, these two phases, and what ions are necessary for that to happen. And then it just slides down the axon. Okay, and a nerve impulse can only go in one direction. And as a matter of fact, information can only go from one neuron, all right, from the presynaptic neuron into the postsynaptic neuron. So again, information through a synapse is unidirectional. It's a one-way street. So let's look at the synapse right here and see if you can tell me why information can only go from the presynaptic neuron into the postsynaptic neuron, but not the postsynaptic back up into the presynaptic neuron. Why is that? If you look at the structures right here, why is that function like that? It has to do with the structure. Okay. Ah, vesicles, because what neuron has the signaling molecule to release? Which neuron has the neurotransmitter? Only the presynaptic neuron. The postsynaptic neuron doesn't have a neurotransmitter to release, to stimulate, or to control the presynaptic neuron. There's no neurotransmitter down here. That's a good visualization if you saw that. So that's one reason. So the postsynaptic neuron can't send any signals up to the presynaptic neuron. It's got nothing to send. Another reason is because only the postsynaptic neuron right here, and I can see this little dark area right here, has receptors for the signaling molecule. The presynaptic neuron has no receptors in the membrane, so that even if the postsynaptic cell were to release a neurotransmitter, it would never bind to anything on the presynaptic membrane to start another electrical signal in this proximal cell right here. Okay, so those are two reasons. Because only the presynaptic neuron has neurotransmitter, and only the postsynaptic neuron has receptors for that neurotransmitter. So information goes across the synapse in only one direction. Okay. I want to go over some definitions. Remember when we first started talking about bones? There were a lot of definitions about bones, like what's a process, what's a foramen, that kind of stuff. All right, so I would like to use some of, and you have to really know what those definitions are in order to talk about bones at all. So I need to make some, to clarify some definitions of nervous system structures so I can use them in the rest of the class. All right, so here they are. We got gray matter. Right, we got a nuclei, we got ganglia, we got white matter, nerve tract, and a nerve. So let's find out what some of these terms are. They're very specific terms. Okay, and I'm looking at the slide on the right, and where's my cursor? Here it is. It disappeared. Where did it go? Ah, there it is. Okay, gray matter. All right, so it's kind of a color term, gray as opposed to white matter. So we're gonna contrast gray matter versus white matter. And in order to do that, let's look over at the slide over here on the left. Here we have a neuron that's in yellow, and then here we have some what? Support cells that are making this myelin sheath. All right, when you have a part of a neuron without a myelin sheath on it, it really doesn't look yellow, it looks gray. So when you see gray matter in the central nervous system, what are you really looking at? Axons or cell bodies and dendrites? Cell bodies and dendrites, because they're not myelinated, right? So, and there are certain places in the brain that have gray matter, okay, like the cortex, that's a superficial part of the brain, that's gray matter, because it's loaded with dendrites and cell bodies. All right, so in the nervous system, gray matter is a group or cluster of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, because that's the part of a neuron that does not have myelin on it, right? Okay, and typically we find that in the cortex of the central nervous system. All right, the cortex as opposed to what part? Cortex as opposed to what part of the brain? What is the opposite? If you say cortex, then you should think of something that makes it different from another part of the brain. Same thing for a bone. The cortex is on the outside of the bone, and what's the deep part of the bone called? The medulla, right? Like the medullary cavity, and even in a bone, all right, there's a medulla, right? The cortex, which is the surface of the brain, is loaded with, if we look on the left-hand side, cell bodies and dendrites, so it looks gray. If you look at some of the deeper parts of the brain, we're going to see that it's loaded with myelinated axons. It's going to look white. It's going to have a difference in color. A good example of that, for instance, would be the cerebellum. Those of you that had a lab with nervous system already, and you remember that pattern that you saw in the cerebellum, the arbor vitae, that shows a nice differentiation between gray matter and white matter. Okay. Nucleus, right? Nuclei is plural. Now, you know, in anatomy, there are times when one term can mean a lot of different things. And so here is one of those terms again. A nucleus, you could think of an atom. And in the nucleus of an atom, you have protons and neutrons, as opposed to the outer parts of an atom that contains electrons. Right. In cell biology, the nucleus is what? Looking at the slide on the left, is this thing that's membrane-bound that contains DNA in the nucleolus, right? So here's the nucleus. But in terms of neuroanatomy, a nucleus is something different. It's a group of nerve cell bodies deep inside the central nervous system, right? So it's going to be thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of what? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Right, and what's the color of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, no matter where it is? It's going to be gray. Most of the deeper parts of the brain are white because it contains myelin, but in a few areas, you see blotchy patterns of gray matter, and because it's a functional center of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and that's what we call a nucleus. They have special functions. We'll talk about some of those functions a little bit later on. All right, so that's central nervous system has nuclei. There is a counterpart to that in the peripheral nervous system, right? So you could break all your nervous system down into central or peripheral. And if you find a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system, we don't call it a nucleus. We call it a ganglion. And what color is it going to look like? A ganglion, nerve cell bodies. And dendrites, nerve cell bodies and dendrites on the left-hand side over here, they're going to look gray, right? So a ganglion is kind of gray. And where do you find a ganglion? Peripheral nervous system, right? So a nucleus and a ganglion are pretty much exactly the same thing, except one is in the CNS, the other is in the PNS. Okay. White matter. What can you tell me about white matter? It is myelinated axons. And white matter in particular, all right, well, that's just what white matter is. It's just myelinated axons. And these axons could be in two locations. They could be in the peripheral nervous system or central nervous system, right? And if they're in the central nervous system, myelinated axons, so it's a whole bunch, you could think of them as a cable with a whole bunch of wires going someplace in the brain or spinal cord, we call it a tract, right? But if it's a whole bunch of myelinated axons going someplace in the peripheral nervous system, like down your arm, and you bang it by accident in your elbow sometimes, we call that not a tract, but a nerve, right? So myelinated axons in the peripheral nervous system is a nerve. Myelinated axons in the central nervous system is a tract. All right, so that's one distinction. Well, we talked about that already. Okay, so the last thing we want to talk about is a nerve. All right, where do we find nerves? Well, we just said. Yeah, peripheral nervous system. Okay, and remember, we looked at a muscle before, and we were able to break a muscle down into, what, fascicles? Fascicles were made out of muscle cells that we call fibers, right? So there's that hierarchical organization. Same thing for a nerve. Now don't forget, this is a bunch of axons going someplace in the peripheral nervous system. They're all packaged together in a special way. Some nerves are really big. They need their own blood supply. Right? And it's not just one cell, it's what? It could be thousands or hundreds of thousands of nerve axons. Right? And each one will be in bundles. And guess what we call a bundle of nerve axons going someplace? That's a fascicle, just like in the muscle. Okay. So the connective tissue sheath that surrounds the whole nerve is what we call the epineurium. The connective tissue that surrounds a fascicle, which still contains thousands of nerve fibers, we call that the perineurium, just like in a muscle, right? And then there's connective tissue that surrounds every single cell or axon, and we call that the endoneurium, right? So that's a pretty complicated structure in the central nervous system. You don't need such complexity, right? And so so tracts are a little bit different compared to nerves. There's a lot more structure in nerves in the periphery compared to tracts in the central nervous system. Tracts don't have all these different layers of connective tissue around them. Okay. So I think this is a good exam figure. I think it's an exam figure in your study guide. Okay. Well, let's talk about how some of these things function together. All right, how do nerves function together? We kind of looked at it on that first slide of nervous system. All right, where's that? Oh, wrong one. I don't have it open anymore. Okay, well, let me use this one. All right, you have an afferent neuron. Okay, so this is a sensory neuron. Does anybody remember the shape of that nerve that's an afferent neuron? It was a pseudo-unipolar neuron. Brings information in, and then integration happens with a multipolar neuron or an association neuron inside the brain, and that sends information out the motor neuron. So information goes in with an afferent nerve, and it leaves on an efferent nerve. And we're interested in how your body is controlled, protects itself. If I look on the slide on the right over here, it does so with reflexes. So it's going to have the same kind of neuronal pattern right here. So let's look at some reflexes. The basic reflex that we're going to be looking at, okay, is something, I think this is pretty good, right here. So guess what we got right here? What's this block of tissue called? Integument, right? And so here we have some kind of damaging stimulus to our body. That could be maybe a match, right? Could be temperature. Right, it could be some kind of ripping motion or puncture wound, and you have receptors, hopefully, that can monitor that tissue damage. Right, so you have pressure receptors, free nerve endings for pain, and then that information is sent to the central nervous system via what? An afferent neuron or a sensory neuron. Afferent or sensory neuron is the same. All right, so that enters, and here's that pseudo-unipolar neuron that enters the spinal cord, that's part of the central nervous system. And here's a synapse in the spinal cord, and you don't have any conscious thoughts being produced by the spinal cord, that these things just depolarize and send information. If you're going to have an appreciation for this needle, where does that information have to go? All the way from the spinal cord up to your brain, to the cortex, for you to have an appreciation of it. So this is something that happens even without your conscious thought. So that stimulates this interneuron, and that interneuron then synapses with a motor neuron, which sends an electrical signal to this muscle. When the muscle receives an electrical impulse, guess what it's going to do? It's going to contract and withdraw that part of your body away from this damaging stimulus. And this all happens very fast without your conscious thought. This is what we call a reflex. And so your spinal cord can actually make very important decisions for you. Like what? Moving your body away from damaging stimulus so it doesn't become so damaged. Like when you pick up a hot pan, guess what your hand is doing before you even know your hand is burning? It's dropping the pan and you're moving away from the stove. You're pushing away with your other arm. Okay, and that happens at the level of the spinal cord, and then at a later time you go, oh damn, I burned myself, right? But your body is protecting itself before you even know about it. So this is a typical kind of reflex. Let's go over the parts of the reflex. The first thing, and it's not labeled on this slide, the first thing is that there has to be a stimulus, right? Stimulus is the first thing. The second thing, in order for your body to appreciate that stimulus, like if I shine a flashlight on you, what do you need in order to appreciate that light blasting you in the face? You need receptors, right? Second thing is receptor for stimulus, all right? But it's got to get into your brain. How does it get into your brain? Via a sensory neuron. What's another name for a sensory neuron? Afferent neuron, okay? That takes it to the central nervous system, right? And then there are neurons in the central nervous system that pass that information around and make a decision, all right? And it sends information out the motor neuron, all right? So here is the efferent neuron going to a skeletal muscle, all right? And when I shine that flashlight in your eye, okay, what muscle is this right here? Orbicularis oculi. What's it going to do? It's going to contract and it's going to protect your eyes from that blast of light, unless I tell you ahead of time, keep your eyes open for extra credit or something, right? Okay. Then you can, because it's voluntary muscle, you can keep your eyes open if you wanted to. So that muscle is what we call an effector. And what does the effector do? It produces a response. All right. So maybe I want to start here next time. All right. So you got stimulus, receptor, afferent neuron, integration center, efferent neuron, effector producing a response. Yeah. If you add all of these different components together, then it's a reflex. Yeah.
Do you think you're going to have exam and have something to do too?
Yeah. So check back.
Can I check back on the next week?
Yeah.
After the exam.
Yeah, yeah.
After